Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
I have Kevin and Ian from Nam Phong Dialogues here with me. I am so excited to talk to you both about your journey in podcasting. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over.
Thanks for having us. I'm a longtime fan, so very happy to be here.
So, Kenneth, to be totally honest, I think a while back when we discovered your podcast and like the lineup of people that you had, we're like, Kevin, one of these days, we're going to go on this podcast.
One of these days.
Oh, it finally happened. And so when you reached out.
I reached out to you guys. So that, I mean, it's flattering, but it's sad at the same time that I had to reach out to you guys. And you guys, well, one day you will be on this podcast, you know?
I think one must be chosen.
Kevin, you're hilarious. You know, I'm not going to lie. I have this sort of like academic worship. I worship people in academia, and I've gotten rid of the problem in the last few years. It's steadily going down because I realize you guys are humans too. But I carry that, you know, that weight from an uneducated mother. She only finished second grade, so she constantly put that on me. She's like, we're never good enough unless we get that PhD. Mm-hmm. And it was constant. Every time I mentioned about getting a master's or a PhD, she kept pushing. She's like, you should do it. And so every time I run into academics on the podcast or in real life, so it's really ironic to hear you guys say one day you'll be on my podcast when I'm like, oh my God, I'm like chomping at the bit to get you guys on my podcast, worrying about you guys not coming on because the response on Instagram DM with you guys have been like, you know, I think one person's waiting for the other to respond. And I'm like, are these guys coming on or not? You know? So thank you both for coming on.
Also the different time zones, that's like an added factor. Yeah. We are in three different time zones right now.
Yes, that's right. You're in Saigon. And then Kevin, you're in Amsterdam.
I'm in Amsterdam.
That's amazing. Yeah. But we will definitely get into that. I think we should start where can we talk a little bit about who each of you are? And then we'll get into sort of the journey of the podcast. And Ian, we'll probably start with you.
Okay, sounds good. So hi, everyone. My name is Ian. I am California raised, born in Vietnam. And I moved to California quite young and very much like you and your parents, really honing in the education that to me was the ticket out of anywhere or to go anywhere is to get educated. So that's why I ended up getting a PhD, because even though I never knew what I would get my PhD in, I knew that I would get a PhD or like I would at least try. Little did I know that it actually took a long time. That's really quite hard. But I did my research and my PhD in a French department. So I worked on French literature. And it was really from there that I started getting interested back in Vietnam. I was interested in questions about expression. Why would the Vietnamese choose French to write their literature? I was also a literary scholar. So that question is really the question that channels or drives most of my research still today. But I, you know, and it's like asking anyone today, why would you choose a language that's not your mother tongue to write your poetry or write your literature? And so I currently teach at Fulbright University in Vietnam. I've been in this position for 3 years. This is coming up my third. And I've done a number of different postdocs and academic positions, but I found myself back here in Vietnam, and that's been really rewarding so far. Yeah.
I have a lot of questions about Fulbright, but we'll get to that after we talk about,
All right, my turn. So, hi, everyone. My name is Kevin Pham. And since we're talking about education and PhDs, I actually didn't know what a PhD was until I was a senior year, in my senior year of college. I was born and raised in San Jose, California. And when I went to college, I thought I was going to be a tattoo artist. And so I was very serious about that. I drew a lot. Nice. I had a portfolio. I was going around to different tattoo shops asking if I could be an apprentice. But at the time, I was getting interested in political theory, which is basically just deep philosophical questions about how we should organize our society. What is a good life? Who should have power? And I went on a trip to the Middle East, which changed my life overnight. And when I came back, I was no longer interested in tattoos. I wanted to study the world. I suddenly started reading a lot. And there was a professor who I really admired, and I basically just wanted to be him. And I was so impacted by him. And so I eventually went down that academic path. And I am now a professor, assistant professor of political theory at the University of Amsterdam. And before that, I was an assistant professor of political science at Gettysburg College, a small liberal arts college.
So I want to apologize to the audience. I think we're going to shut this podcast down right now. Each of you need your own episode. I made a mistake here. Oh my God, my brain is like turning like a million miles an hour, and I'm so sorry that we have to look. We're going to get each of you on your own a podcast, but today we're just going to try to like push through and balance this. You know, I find that to have both of you such powerful academics, you deserve your own episode, and we will get to that. But today we'll go through the Nam Phong dialogues, and you know, I have so many questions about Fulbright and your Phuc Tran from Saigon. He wrote Saigon. He's also a tattoo artist, and you know, classic. So there's parallels there with your life, and I wonder how much you know about his journey and all of that. And you know, why did you go to the Middle East? And I went to the Middle East, and I have so many questions about why it changed you. All right, so there goes my ADD. My brain going in like 1,000 directions. Okay, so now that we know that about both of you, where and how did you both meet? I mean, I know the answer to that because I've already listened to that episode that you guys put out, but the audience doesn't know. I already know that, and that's why I'm going to ask you more questions about how you met and all that. Yeah, Kevin.
I think it's fair for me to go first because I think I saw Ian before Ian saw me, and that's because... let me explain.
Tell us how you really feel, Kevin.
I was in the audience when Ian was giving a paper presentation at Sciences Po in Paris. This was the summer of 2017. And it was a crowded audience. You know, I was sitting in the back. And what struck me was that, so Ian was delivering this presentation in perfect fluid French. I thought she was French. At that point, I could understand French, so I could follow it. And she was talking about this Vietnamese thinker, Nguyen Minh Tu, and saying how he loved Michel de Montaigne. And that made me really excited because Montaigne is my favorite philosopher of all time. So then after that, I went right up to her and I was like, oh my gosh, I loved your presentation. And so from there, we became friends. And
that the rest of the three.
And how long ago was that?
So that's
2017.
17?
17.
Okay. 17. 17. Yeah. So that's about 7 years ago.
And And Ian, how did your French get so good?
Okay, I think Kevin's memory did a little like flip there because I was reading quotes in French, but I did not deliver this paper in French. At least I don't think so. But I had taken French in high school, and then also, that was my PhD. So if I didn't know how to speak French, that would be very questionable. I also spent a lot of time in France, in Paris and Bordeaux. So I've had opportunities to improve my French.
Got it.
Right. And at that time, so Ian had been in France for about a year, right?
Yeah.
And then I was just entering. So we were like tag teaming Paris. And I was there for a year. And so we started keeping in touch. Then right after that, Ian organized this panel in Copenhagen. And then ever since then, we've just been meeting each other at conferences.
And where did the idea of having a podcast come from?
Well, that was much later. what was nice about meeting Kevin was he was very easy to get along with. I remember that same day I was like, oh, well, I need to go buy some oils for my mom. And he was like, okay, I'll come. And so he went with me to get these essential oils for my mom. And no, it was Algerian oils. And then being able to just talk about anything, that was like a first step to building our friendship. And then we realized we had very similar research interests. We were interested in intellectuals who wrote during the early 20th century. And this is kind of where the beginnings of our podcast emerged, because there's two parts. The first part is just having enough conversations where we're like, you know what, these conversations are really good. Like, we should write a paper, or we should do something together. And then one day we're just like, what if we had a podcast? And so that was kind of the beginning semination. So you want to tell more of the story, Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I grew up in San Jose, like I said, but I actually did not have many Vietnamese American friends. And so Ian was kind of the first person I met who was from California, who was interested in intellectual, philosophical things. I came from a Catholic family background, you know, doing a PhD. So for the first time, I felt like I could explore what it meant to be Vietnamese American and also in this intellectual space. And so it was really helpful to have someone to talk with, you know, to get feedback from. That's how we develop as thinkers. We can't think alone. We need other people. And so I think our podcast idea came about, especially when we were at a retreat in Seattle with other Vietnam scholars. So there were scholars of Vietnam, and actually Kenneth, you know, Duong Vu, he invited us. He helped to organize it. And there we pitched this idea to those people, and Duong also, and they were like, yeah, go for it. And Duong Vu was very generous. He helped, you know, give us some financial assistance, for example, like for the music. And yeah, so it was really, the point is that we needed that community.
Wait, hold up. Did you guys go to that last year in Oregon?
No. Not the one you were at.
Yeah. So you guys went to the one before, the earlier one. Okay.
Yeah. But so that's how it got started.
Yeah, and
got it.
And then the name is a tribute to the scholar that we both study at some point. So I wrote an article on someone named Pham Quynh, and Kevin wrote a whole book chapter on someone named Pham Quynh. And so this individual, this intellectual, started this journal called Nam Phong Tạp Chí, or the Southern Wind Review. And it really tried to capture an ethos that was the spirit of intellectual exchange. There were research articles written in different languages, Mandarin, Vietnamese, and French. There were glossaries so that people can learn new vocabulary words. There were administrative reports, but also works of fiction, works of literature. And in that spirit, in the ethos of the Southern Wind, that was that journal we decided to call our podcast now dialogues.
And I want to say a little bit more about that ethos, because Phat Quyen, in that journal, he's basically trying to marry Vietnamese culture and French culture. And it seemed like since Ian and I met in France and we are interested in French philosophers and we have this Vietnamese background, we kind of want to do the same sort of, you know, maybe not Vietnam and France, but also kind of East, West, that kind of, how did these cultures talk to each other? That's what we're interested in.
You know, I've had a problem with being colonized on a very basic level, French coming into Vietnam. And I think that growing up, that was like something that weighed heavily on me. And I pushed back on the Vietnamese Catholic culture and really questioned the French influence and really French aesthetics too, prevailing in my family. I hated it. And the older I've gotten, though, the more I'm beginning to sort of just be open to the idea that organically this has happened, and that now meeting, like now sitting with both of you, seeing the appreciation of somebody who is trying to marry this idea of French and Vietnamese culture in a journal. Do you both have feelings that do you guys share the feelings that I have or have had with either your American side or your this idea of French influence in our Vietnamese culture?
Do you want to take that?
I can start. I think my feelings toward any kind of Western influence is complex, because on the one hand, I mean, I am Vietnamese, but I grew up mainly in the West. And then seeing here how much, you know, the West has influenced Vietnam. I guess this speaks specifically in the context of French and Vietnam. Like, how do I feel in relation to the French influences that exist in Vietnam? Quite ambivalent, because on the one hand, I think it helps Vietnam, like, have multiple solutions to one problem, different ways of looking at one problem, let's say. But the reason why it's ambivalent is a lot of those problems were also created by the French. So, or like the conveniences that were brought by the French were mainly to benefit the French. So I think if you look at just like the everyday colonial life, and maybe like the technologies that were brought, like, was it all good? No. And was it all bad? No. I think there are different ways to look at the issue that can be a little bit more complex. And I totally sympathize with someone who feels residue of that animosity or that just anger toward being colonized. And I think that'll take some time. Like, that's never going to go away. I hope you never actually like suppress that anger, because if you channel that anger towards something more productive, then you can have something else. You know, I think a lot of us work with our post-colonial contexts in different ways. But for me, rather than just feeling angry, then maybe it's actually looking into that specific moment where Vietnam and France came into contact, and it became something like my research.
I completely realize that it's a, you know, it's a juvenile way of thinking when you sort of, right? You just take all the chopsticks and go, this is the bundle, they're all bad, right? So I don't do that, because just years of having conversation with people like you guys have opened up my eyes to not, you know, feel one way or the other, but just question everything. And hearing what you're saying is a very beautiful thing. You know, there's nuances in politics, there's nuance in culture, in food and music, there's everything that that exists. You know, there's extremes, and I think we just need to question everything instead of going, you know, I love that beautiful nose. That, are you French, part French? That's what went on in my family for many, many decades. And I
think what you're feeling is not like the hatred toward the French, but it's that privileging of those French traits that diminish the Vietnamese, you know, the Vietnamese qualities. Like, those qualities are also great in different ways, but But yes,
absolutely,
I totally get it.
You know, this is making me realize that, Kenneth, I'm listening to you, and I realize, like, I did not grow up with that. I did not grow up, I mean, I grew up in a Vietnamese American family, but I never was really exposed to any kind of French anything, except maybe my mom would watch Paris by Night, but that's literally it. But now you're making me realize, though, that recently I was talking with my dad, and he said, oh, Kevin, all the Vietnamese here in San Jose, all my friends, they all love the French. They're like, ooh. And I was like, really? I didn't know that until like a few months ago.
That's
news to me. When I was growing up, I almost felt more like, why am I so colonized by China? because I would go every month to do gong, you know, with a family altar, incense sticks. When I was a teenager, I was like, where does this tradition come from? It's all Confucian. Lunar New Year, that's Chinese. I mean, this is all like, so I felt more like, why am I Chinese? Or what is the difference between the Vietnamese and the Chinese if we're doing the same thing?
That's a whole nother podcast. Yes. Chinese and Vietnamese culture. Going back to the French, yes, Vietnamese people of the first generation diaspora love the fact that they were French educated. Like, the elites love the fact that, you know, I went to a French high school. It's something that they wear with a badge of honor. And for me, that was a problem growing up. It became a problem growing up because even the most uneducated, like on my mother's side, we have French bloodlines. We're all like 6 foot tall, and we're, you know, we have the nose. You know, my brother and my mom's side of the family, the beautiful French noses. And then I was like, all right, cool. So a few years ago, we did a 23andMe test. My brother and I came back 90. I mean, it was insane. My brother and I actually were like 25, 30% Chinese because of my dad's side. And then there was no European blood at whatsoever. And we showed it to our family. And like, there's no, and then they're like, no, we don't believe in that stuff. That's like technology that, and we're like, okay, all right. So this is how deep this stuff runs. Yeah. But it also, my dad was a Francophile and he read Victor Hugo. He, you know, really believed in French literature as sort of like, you know, enlightenment and all of these movements that Vietnam doesn't have or didn't have for him growing up. So that appreciation for him being French educated, and then my mom's side with the aesthetics really made me turn, you know, it was a turn off. And so I am finding my way back into conversation, nuanced conversation with people who know better.
That's interesting. Maybe it's relevant here to say that my wife is French. And
the so ultimate Francophile.
We did long distance for 7 years, but I would spend every summer for like 3 months in France and getting to know the family. But then I realized that, yeah, I've been hanging out with a lot of French people, like the professor that I had mentioned earlier. He's American, but his wife is French and they only speak French at home. And I lived with them. And yeah, I've been exposed to a lot of Frenchness, but it really wasn't until after college. Like, there was nothing French in my life before then. So it's really interesting to hear this from you.
Yeah, it was everywhere. I had a restaurant in 1997 and all I would do is play French music at the campus at UCLA, the Westwood Village. And we had like a little patio and we just blare French music. That was like we're Vietnamese. We're going to play French music of the 40s, the Belle Epoque with Edith Piaf and, you know, Charles, I forget his last name. But all that kind of music of those years is the music that brought sort of like this ambiance to like this patio dining, you know, experience at UCLA. And I thought that was the right thing, but turns out that, it's questionable. You know, when I look back, it's very questionable.
Yeah, but I think that is a trend. Like, there is a certain nostalgia for that. I don't know if it's nostalgia for the colonial era. I don't know if it's just nostalgia for that cultural contact that happens so freely in a different way that we don't have here in the same way, in the same sense. And, you know, it's always when it's in the past and you're no longer feeling the hurt from the past, then it's easy to be nostalgic about it. But I think nostalgia is one aspect, and that's why, you know, people are very, I think there are people are, they're more Francophile than I would think they would be, considering it's a post-colonial territory, you know. And then the other aspect is for the people who read Victor Hugo or the literature, the French literature, I think they were also looking for novelty, for something new. So like new forms and new things that didn't exist in Vietnam. And I think that's a very rational thing to pursue, is to pursue novelty.
You know, my brother and I first went back to Vietnam 25 years ago, and we started going back quite a bit. We had a factory with my parents, and we were running this thing. And then in the first few years, we were chest puffed up high. We're Americans. And then after you're there for about 2-3 years, you start to realize, you know, my brother moved back to Vietnam. He was born in Vietnam, moved back. And then we start to realize that this is not the way to behave. Could you start to see other Vietcues coming back to Vietnam, you know, with the same sort of like flag waving kind of feel, right? And you're like, well, this is not the way to integrate. And then I started to kind of like project out like 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now when, you know, Vietcues from the U.S. is coming back to Vietnam, are they going to have that same weird Francophile nostalgia about America when they're resettling? Like if we ever lost the United States to China and all of these Vietnamese to return back to the homeland, are we going to one day look back and go, America, we are, you know, I think that's a sickness, a nationalistic sickness to carry this nostalgia back to the homeland, to Vietnam, because, you know, we're blinded by this identity that we are Americans sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I think going back to Vietnam, we got to shed that. And we got to be very aware that Vietnam has a very special identity without these American and French influences.
You know, this is reminding me, because right after college, I decided to move to Vietnam and live there for 8 months. I was in Nha Trang. I was teaching English. And right before I left, my dad told me, he said, look, Kevin, sometimes when Viet Kieu, especially American Viet Kieu, when they go to Vietnam, they think they're so badass. Just being mean. Don't be one of those. I don't think you will. But one thing you should do is for every word you speak, listen to five.
Wow.
Basically, listen much more than you speak. And I thought that was really good advice, because I would show up, I would ask questions and let people talk. And I would ask them, what do you think of Viet Kieu? And some of them did tell me like, yo, we have some issues with them, but you know, you're fine. So, just be there and be curious and just listen.
Ian, were you going to say something?
No, but I do think that when you travel, when you go anywhere, and obviously you were bringing yourself, but that's kind of all you need. You don't need to bring any extra like identities or armors. Absolutely. Or anything like that. You're like the whole point of travel is to be in that in-between space where you can do anything and be anyone. And so like it would be such a waste. To me, it's such a waste to like carry that American identity with you everywhere and like tout it as if like I feel like there's so many other things that you can potentially experiment with, like why not, you know?
Right. The thing though, it's like the beauty of this, I guess, is like even if you don't say anything about your Americanness, they are going to see you and they're going to be like, oh, you're the American guy, and whether you like it or not, you're representing America to them. And so that's the best way to represent.
But that's what I mean. You already carry that regardless. Yeah. So you don't need to tout it about, right. You know?
Yeah. I would add the only thing you need to bring to any country is curiosity. Mm. That's what you need to bring. You need to bring loads of curiosity and show people how curious you are about their culture.
You scratch,
and other than that, leave everything.
You scratch Kevin's itch right there. That's something Kevin would say.
Yeah. I love that word. Yeah.
It's true. I think that's why we are all in the podcasting space, because it allows us to really, really satisfy this curiosity, mm-hmm. right? Because I think being in the podcast space, I never get satisfied with enough scratching or this. I'm not ever satiated. Mm-hmm. It never goes away, because I'm just so dying for information constantly. I want to listen to how people feel and think about the Vietnamese identity, the Vietnamese culture. And with that being said, how do you both from two different countries, mm-hmm. two different time zones, come together and say, hey, we're going to create a podcast? And so how did that in the beginning start out?
I'm trying to think of those early days of brainstorming. So they definitely happened during COVID. And COVID's during, it's a special time where, we look at it now, a special.
it was special.
Where everything was kind of up in the air. And so anything was possible. And at least for me, I that was my optimistic view of things. Nothing is confirmed now. So now everything is possible. And we were like, yeah, why don't we just try this podcast? And so I think we had brainstormed of things we would want to talk about. But it came out that we would want to do some book reviews or have conversations about ideas that were interesting to us. But I'm remembering that our first episode was maybe just to get to know each other. And then the second episode was on Theros. It was on this idea that Kevin had pitched about being about traveling. And that's your duty is to go out in the world, explore it, and then bring it back and share with your community. And that's essentially, that captures the essence of what we want to do in this podcast, is we want to go out in the world, maybe that's do research, talk to other people, read their books, and then bring it back to share with our community.
And bring it back in a way where we translate it either literally from different languages or conceptually, say it in a way that our community can, understand. So this podcast also was sort of an excuse for us to read the books we wanted to read, but so we could read it together. For example, our third episode was Martina Nguyen's book.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, Martina Nguyen.
Yeah. And so... So that episode on hybridity in Vietnam. So the podcast was also, for me at least, kind of a strategic sort of, because in this academic business, as a professor, you have to publish. And so this podcast is an excuse to do research and learn new things and get ideas for articles. So I thought it was good for my intellectual journey, and I assume same goes for you.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like you had said earlier, you can't really have conversations by yourself. I mean, you can, and I have. I do. They just only get to a certain point when you have someone else.
Yeah, it's true.
They challenge you, and then you start.
You need resistance.
And then, exactly. You need resistance to grow stronger, and you need to be pushed in different angles or areas that you didn't think you would go. And I think that's important to explore that new territory. But, I think logistically, though, what your question was getting at, we weren't in two different countries when we started. We were in the U.S. and we were on the same time zone. And then slowly, I went to Vietnam, and then Kevin went to Amsterdam. So we just got further and further away from each other. But this is the ultimate test, I guess, is being able to still find a time once a month, record our episode, and touch base on what is it we want to communicate with our community.
And also I should mention there was a sense of duty as well. I mean, we both were lucky to have these opportunities in academia. And when I was younger, when I was in college trying to learn about Vietnam, all I had honestly were long detailed history books that were kind of boring to read, honestly, and kind of wish I had a podcast, so we wanted to do it for the young, for the young folks.
Yeah.
And it's been working, you know, like we get emails from strangers, from young people who say, I was late one night, I wanted to learn about Vietnam. I Googled around and found your podcast and I loved it. And the other day I went to a Vietnamese restaurant here in Amsterdam. And then it turns out that the waitress loves our podcast.
Wow.
Like, this is it's so easy.
You know, I want to really encourage you both never to stop. And I'll tell you why I feel that way. I know it gets hard. I live it. And I guess I'm telling myself this too. But I know it's got to be doubly hard with two people. Right? Because you're like depending on each other and, you know, who's doing more of the workload. There could be like built up feelings about resentment. Like who's doing, there could be a million things going on. Right. But I just encourage you to both to kind of go as long as you possibly can. And here's why. I've listened to your podcast. You guys go so deep with the topics. I have learned so much with the episodes that I've listened to, like the sympathizer one that I listened to. I never thought about empathize and sympathize. And in Vietnamese and in those two words in Vietnamese, when you guys drill down on those topics, they're so deep and profound. They make the listener really think about how special having this dual sort of living in two worlds are. And I really appreciate it. I hope it never stops. And I just stumbled on your podcast recently, and I'm such a big fan. And I've listened to about four or five now. And I'm going to go through all of them. And I want to hear more. And I want to learn more. And I think that there is niches all over our community that are not being filled. And I think the academic podcast, you two are probably at the leading edge of this. And, you know, Tracy has the Vietnamese book People, and she's doing that. I'm just doing everything. Whoever I can touch, whoever I can reach out to, but then that academic niche is so powerful because the critical thinking that you two bring to the table is phenomenal work.
Thank you. It does mean a lot.
Yeah,
and really. I think when you're able to tell me that, it means that we've done something right, that we communicated properly. I had forgotten that we talked about empathize and sympathize, actually. But you're absolutely right about dwelling in the in-between space, and like without the proper guidance or without the proper, I guess, community, it's really easy just kind of fall in the cracks. And for me and for Kevin, we kind of imagine our targeted, you know, our ideal audience. It's like someone who is 18 years old, 20 years old, who's kind of figuring out who they are, and maybe they want to go in academia, or maybe they just want to learn more about Vietnam. But having something that speaks their language, it is technical sometimes. We do have these kind of academic-y moments, but for the most part, if there's anything that can kind of reach them, I think that's the makes me feel very satisfied.
Yeah. Can you both talk about how you pick a topic and then break a topics down, and then sort of how you, the process of putting together a podcast episode?
Maybe we should just simply start with the very last one. So the last episode we did was about our fathers.
No, it's okay. You can share it. It's okay. By the time this comes out, that one will come out.
Yeah,
right. Right. Okay. Spoiler alert. I won't spoil it too much, but basically, our last episode was about our fathers, namely how our relationship with our fathers have changed over time, and what that meant for us as Vietnamese Americans who were studying Vietnam. And so we came up with that podcast because, partly because of me. I was talking to my mother-in-law. She's French. She listens to our podcast. You know, her English it's there. It's good. I mean, she can understand, you know. And so I asked her, what should we do? And she said, I want to hear more about your parents. So the episode we had before that was about our mothers, and we told the stories of our mothers. And so it seemed to make sense we should do it about our fathers. And so do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that we organize and plan for our podcast is very, it's very much like writing an article. So, or like writing some kind of academic work. We always ask ourselves, what are the guiding questions? And it's like an article, like a book, what are my research questions? And then to bring things closer down to earth, we always close with, what is it that we want others to take away from this? And I think those two operating things, having guiding questions and then always asking yourself, what is it that I want my audience to take away from this? That not only makes you a good communicator, it makes you a good teacher. It seems so simple, but it's actually quite hard for a lot of people. So those, I think every episode has some kind of form of that. If it's a book that we're reviewing, for example, we'll talk about, you know, the conditions around the book, what each of us thought, like how we did with the sympathizer. But we'll generally, because there's so many things to talk about and we're just the two of us and we have a limited hour, usually it's what are like 2 points?
Yeah.
Yeah, less is more.
And we have a Google Doc that we mm-hmm. throw ideas on and then we structure it. So there is some structure that we want to follow. But I agree with Yen, it's got to be coherent and unified somehow, motivated by a question.
But there's a lot of subjects. I can't imagine landing on, you know, and picking a subject. Or maybe having like so many and then going, well, how do we pick this out?
So as Kevin mentioned, like we get a lot of our ideas from our listeners. Listeners who pitch ideas. And we love that. We want to do episodes that you want to hear. So we've had people pitch like films. Like, could you do a review of this? Like the sympathizer, a review of the show, the adaptation. That was something that was pitched to us. Even the Ken Burns documentary. I can't remember if someone had pitched this, but regardless, someone had asked me, will you do a review of the Ken Burns documentary? And that was already in the works. So
have you guys done that one yet?
It's one of the earlier ones. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. I got to check that one out. I'm dying to hear what you guys think of that.
And another one was Ian and I, we presented at this conference at Fulbright University Vietnam about the Don King Nghĩa Thục, the Tonkin Free School. At school from 1907 and why it was so significant. It was one of the first schools to expose Vietnamese students to ideas from the West. And so we did a series on that, right? We had 2 episodes on that. And so we do series as well. We had like a freedom series, like the meaning of freedom according to communists and according to anti-communists and, you know, the different ways to understand freedom. So we do series.
So now I do want to get into Fulbright. Recently, my episode with Chi Thuy from Fulbright, the president of Fulbright, I don't know why recently it's gotten attacked. They don't attack me. They attacked her mm-hmm. on that episode that I did with her. And I've asked a few people and I don't get the real answers. So I'm reading the comments and they're all in Vietnamese. I'm fluent in Vietnamese and I'm reading it and I don't understand why it just happened because that episode was like 2 years ago maybe, and all of a sudden there's a snowball. And I think about Fulbright and I think about academic freedom and I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to bring this up with you today and talk to you about what does true academic freedom in Vietnam look like at Fulbright today in Vietnam. How does the people of Vietnam, the government, the people, I sometimes you can separate it, sometimes you can't, because I'm like, wait, these netizens are attacking this idea of this Western educated president, President Thuy, which went to Wharton. Mm-hmm. And now I'm trying to figure out how do people in Vietnam really feel about an education at Fulbright because of now what I've read in the last few months, this attack on former President Tui.
So there's a lot of information to unpack there. Where do I start? I think I'll just kind of start with some of the facts that have been cleared out recently in the past month or two, which is that we had a disinformation campaign that was launched against Fulbright. And this circulated a number of slander, a number of information that was not true. Things like it's an institution that is cultivating a color revolution. And that's not even Western language. That's the language that is used against, you know, what's happening in Bangladesh. This was a U.S. institution that we were, you know, kind of cultivating American sympathizers, a number of things, but it was very clear that it was targeted because right before our enrollments in the new school year. So what happened was at first it was just social media, and there was a mistake where some of this messaging appeared on a governmental platform. It was quickly taken down, but by the time it had taken down, it already circulated. So this means that now there's a lot of information that has been out that is not true about Fulbright, because from the very beginning, the U.S. and Vietnam were in this together. It was a bilateral collaboration between the two nations.
Yeah.
And the Vietnamese government and its leadership up until then have always been very supportive of Fulbright and its mission.
Totally on board.
Yes.
Yeah.
So now we're kind of having to deal with some of the repercussions of that disinformation campaign. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of students are very concerned. Their parents are very concerned. And Kenneth, you should know that my aunt, who lives in San Jose, she send me a screenshot of my face with the tagline, "You're starting a revolution. Where is my national flag?" Like, so this was a video that I was in for commencement, and things were taken out of context. Things were taken out of context. Saying that, oh, we didn't fly the Vietnamese national flag, like, oh, we're not patriotic. And so she sent me this screenshot, and she was like, "You know, is everything okay?" And I was like, "It's fine. It's just, you know, this is not something that we have control over." And essentially, I think that captures like how I feel too about this whole thing, is that we could not have prevented this, you know. And I think to a certain extent, Fulbright could have anticipated this, because when an institution like Fulbright comes into a place like Vietnam, there's bound to be resistance and there's bound to be people who disagree with our messaging. We just didn't know to what extent and how far it would go. This is really kind of beyond what we were expecting. And so now we have to deal with the consequences. But that's just kind of answering the first question, the first bits of what you brought up. You also asked.
This was like out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Out of nowhere. And it's like bombing my YouTube channel. I'm like, this is nuts that this is happening.
Yeah. And so she's not the only one, right? Because there's also there's other people who have spoken up on our behalf, who have also been attacked, like diplomats who have spoken up on our behalf, who have been attacked. And we were encouraged to just lay low, let it pass, and not engage, because that's really the most that you can do. Once you engage, you give more data points, and like anything that you do could be twisted or turned, you know, because this was our commencement and we did things very officially. We sang the national anthem, you know, there was really nothing else we could have done. So, but on the question of academic freedom,
I
think Kevin can also speak to this, because you were at the conference about the liberal arts education. We had a conference at Fulbright about tracing the origins of the liberal arts education model that is Fulbright to an earlier model, which is the 1907 Tonkin Free School, and saying that, you know, liberal arts kind of has already been in the works for over a century. Fulbright is definitely more free than a lot of other institutions in terms of what students can ask, how students can comport themselves, the way that students relate to professors. And sometimes, you know, students do push that boundary where I'm like, you're still my student. You know, you don't get to challenge everything that I say, especially when, and I'm not just saying that, but like, especially when I'm very intentional about what I teach. So you can't just challenge for the sake of challenging. So sometimes students do that, but most of the time, students really appreciate getting to think in new ways and ask really hard questions and dig into their curiosity. And I think Kevin has experienced that when he's met some of our students too.
Yeah. I mean, I'll just say that I was having dinner with some students from Fulbright, and they were just telling me that they used to hate the subject of history. But then they went to Fulbright, and for the first time, a professor showed them that history is asking questions and, you know, getting a complicated story rather than just being told, you know, taught in a dry way, remembering facts and things like that. And I just have to say, like, they are some of the most brilliant students I've ever seen. I was just blown away when I've been there a few times. And so it was pretty heartbreaking to hear all this negative stuff. I mean, people just have no idea. I mean, they are very proud Vietnamese, you know, very smart. So, yeah, it's just a
shame. Makes me wonder, you know, especially because I work at Fulbright and I've been here for a while, but to ask, is Vietnam ready for a place like Fulbright? And I've asked
this. Yeah, I think about that often.
I've asked this in a different context, and some people say it'll never be, which is really interesting to me. I still haven't really figured out what that means, and I think...
Oh my God, Kevin and I are both raising our hand. We have a lot to say about this. But Kevin, go ahead first, and I'm going to give my two cents.
I just want to say that, like, you know, in Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, the book street, mm-hmm. right? Every time I go back to Vietnam, and I try to go at least, like, you know, often... but I have seen new books come out in Vietnamese, translations of stuff I would have never expected. Recently, I saw Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom. I saw John Stuart Mill, his Essays on Liberty and Free Speech, translated to Vietnamese. And a few years ago, I think there was either a party member, somebody who got in trouble for translating that book. So there's, like, no doubt a kind of relaxing here. So it seems like, yeah, it's ready for Fulbright. At least that's what it seemed like.
You know, I bring this up in my podcast constantly, which is, you know, is the Vietnamese government communist, or is the Vietnamese government really Confucian driven? And what I mean by that is it's a very top-down society. And even when you think about American democracy, it's like, all right, well, it's just you, me, them. It's not back to go kao kong, right? There's no hierarchy in that American democracy. But I'm really stretching the generalization of this idea of it being a very hierarchical world in Vietnam. So, you know, this idea of, like, all right, well, let's use communism as this hierarchical kind of, like, this is the way we do it in Vietnam. And so when I think about the government, I'm like, communist is just it's a cool name, but it's a cool brand. But really what's at the engine driving the control is this idea of back, go, yeah. You know, it's all of this hierarchical language that's built into the culture. All right, Kevin, let it rip.
All right. I mean, you're asking the political theorists and political scientists here. So I realize I think this is a good moment for me to shamelessly plug something I'm very proud of. For the last 8 years, I've been working on a book about Vietnamese political thought during the colonial period, and it came out 2 days ago. So yay! And it's titled The Architects of Dignity, Vietnamese Visions of Decolonization. And it looks at the political thought of six influential thinkers.
Wait, hold up. Yeah. You just posted something on Viet Sero Traits or something like that?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God. I was like, I swear to God, I was going to, I didn't know it was you. I was going to literally message. I'm like, hey, would you come on the podcast?
Yes, I will. The answer is yes. The answer is yes.
And here you, I did not put one and one together. Oh, my God. I'm such a, dumbass. Oh, my God. No, yes, no. I've been seeing this. And I'm like, all right, I'm gonna message this Kevin guy. Okay, great. This is, oh, my God, the universe works.
We're already talking. But I just want to say, because I want to get to your point about Confucianism and communism. But the book looks at Phan Boi Châu, Phan Chu Trinh, Nguyen An Ninh, Phạm Quyền, Ho Chi Minh, and Nguyễn Mạnh Tùng. My chapter on Ho Chi Minh is about exactly what you're saying, Kenneth. And my response would be that for Ho Chi Minh, he saw communism as being perfectly compatible with Confucianism. In fact, Marxism and Confucianism were essentially the same thing. Here's what I mean by that.
Oh my God, my suspicions all these years are finally being approved here.
Yeah, yeah.
I just always have this strange suspicion that the two are the same.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not just Ho Chi Minh saying this. There's another very well-known Vietnamese historian. His name's Nguyễn Khắc Viễn. And he says the same thing. A lot have said the same thing, which is basically this. So the version of communism that the Vietnamese communist revolutionaries adopted was arguably Leninism. So Leninism requires a vanguard, so a professional, intelligent, wise class of virtuous, moral leaders who will guide the masses towards their vision of socialism. And that's the key word, wise leaders, right? So that's what Lenin was all about. Lenin was like, if you leave the working class or the peasants alone, they're never going to do a revolution. You need wise people to go there, explain to them why they're being oppressed, and then you need to guide them. And Ho Chi Minh basically was like, this is Confucianism. Confucianism is all about moral leadership, getting their legitimacy from being good to the people, and people like, you know, fulfilling their duty to the people, basically. So good leaders need to ensure that people are educated, fed, and that people need to love the leaders. So it's exactly what you're talking about, the uncle and the children. You know, for Confucian society is just simply a big family. That's very different from the West. In the West, society is a contract between individuals. But in Confucianism, we're not just individuals. We each have roles in a family, a set of corresponding duties, right? And that's what the Vietnamese imagine their whole society and government should be. The government's the parents. And the children are, you know, the people are the children. I mean, they call Uncle Ho uncle. That means they accept that they're the children.
You know why? I've always had this weird, strange suspicion about communism and Confucianism, because this shit shows up in Orange County in San Jose. This stuff shows up in weird ways. I'm like, wait, are you guys Americans? Are you guys communists? Because you guys are doing the same thing. You're like limiting conversation. You're putting your control down on what we can say and what we can't say. You're doing the same thing that they're doing, and you're claiming that it's cultural, that we have to follow these cultural rules. You know, that's a very controversial thing for me to say. But there are a lot of people who are Americans who are like, you know, democratic in their way of thinking. And they really push this idea of like, hey, there is no barrier to like this hierarchy. So I'm like telling the older people that I deal with in America, I'm like, guys, like, you guys are thinking the same way as the communists. It's no different. So let's explore and examine why we have so much issue with communists. It's because it's cloaked in, it's all the same. We can't, as American second generation Vietnamese, we can't deal with this anymore. We can't deal with that control. We're like, wait a minute, we got to break down this hierarchy, and we have to be able to really speak our minds. especially the work that both of you do, intellectuals, academics, we have to think about different frameworks that break and shatter these ceilings of hierarchy. So I'm very happy that we are here and talking about this.
Cool.
Can I just briefly say, my dad sent me an email not too long ago, and he was saying the older generation, his older brothers, they just, I wish I had the email with me, but basically it's like, they're stuck in their ways, basically. It's really a generational thing. And so I think it's very much Confucian, you know, the filial piety. What are your thoughts on this yet?
Well, I was interested in maybe bringing this back to the question about whether or not Vietnam is ready for a place or an institution like Fulbright to exist. Because you have these youth who are so well trained in terms of like how to think critically, and they come out and they want to go grad school abroad. And I'm hoping that's really also for them to be trained even further. But I wonder, after they go abroad, will they come back to Vietnam? Or will they look to stay abroad? Like, will they have what they need to sustain them in Vietnam in terms of having a place that allows them to think critically and push against boundaries and ask questions that make sure things are working well, you know? Because if it's going to be where they're equipped with all of this critical thinking, and then the society doesn't allow them to, or like just traps them whenever they finish their asking questions, and then
I have a guess.
What's your guess?
How this is going to play out? Yeah. I have a guess. In 1997, I got to USC and I met a young student, and my brother and I were both a little older. We did military service. We saw this kid, and he was this bright kid, and we found out that he was from Barria, and he had finished high school in Riverside, California. Got to USC, really smart. And then we start to find out that his father was like a local, like bigwig in the government in Barria. And then so the word got around and everybody's like, stay away from that kid. You know, he's communist, blah, blah, blah. So that was like late 90s. And then, you know, he eventually became my roommate. My brother and I, we stayed in an apartment in Koreatown together. We loved him. And his name's Paul. And he got a master's at USC, undergrad at USC, and, you know, stayed in the US for a number of years. And then he went back to Vietnam, and then he started to run IDG, Venture Capital Fund. And he became, you know, he rose very quickly. Mm-hmm. And he began to work with American Vietkios from the United States, like big guys like Henry Nguyen, and work, you know, he's been on the podcast. So none of this is like new information. And so Vol is his name, and the pattern of Fall in the early days was like, okay, I think when they first get here, they're like, oh my God, they're enamored by this idea of like, you know, openness and free speech, and they live this for a good decade or 20 years, and then they go back, and then they're like, okay, well, now we have to operate and bring the new stuff back to Vietnam. Then it's like, so when you leave, it's like 20 steps forward in those 20 years, and then it's like 10, 15 years backwards. So they have to now deal with the backwardness of that society, which is Vietnam's current, whatever, wherever they are in the history of Vietnam. So there's like stratas of these Vietnamese students that are going to the United States, coming back after 15, 20 years. And they're bringing back a lot of knowledge, and they know that they have to like deal with the regression of kind of like blending back in. But eventually a lot of them are going to be in power. And that's the guess of like my VidQ friends who've been in Vietnam for 30 years. I mean, Ivy League guys who are in Vietnam today, after 30 years, they're like, given another 20, 25 years, you'll see all of that, the full fam of the world returning. And yeah, they have that regression. They have that like 15, 20 years, like you have to go back a little bit and deal with like all the 60, 70-year-old party leaders. But they eventually will be the party leaders in 25 years, because they have done their 20 years abroad, brought back these systems, and then they're going to incorporate it and try to figure out how this is all going to work. Mm-hmm. Now, will we get a prime minister like the Singapore, I forget his name. I mean, I should know his name. Yeah. He changed, you know, Singapore. Will we get one person like that that can really clean it up and make it? I don't know, but I'm pretty sure that you're going to have an army of like educated people that came from outside of Vietnam coming back to change Vietnam slowly. And that's my guess.
How do you react to that? I'm curious.
Well, I'm also thinking about that question again. It's like, in that case, you're almost saying I feel like your response to that question is, no, Vietnam is not ready for a place like Fulbright yet, but it seems like there always needs to be that gap. Fulbright, because it's kind of on your terms, like ahead in terms of training the students in a certain way, then a lot of them will want to go abroad. And that forward thinking is what needs to exist in Vietnam to pull it also forward. That's kind of me rehashing what you said, Ken.
I think it's happening. Mm-hmm. I think it's there's a slow change, you know, and they are changing. And you know, RMIT is not a place that you can discount as well, because they all speak English, and a lot of RMIT students. I don't know Fulbright as well as my brother's been over at RMIT for like 18 years, and so I've been on campus many times, and they all speak perfect English, and you're like, wait. Are you born in the United States and just have come here recently to live in Vietnam? My brother's like, no, those kids some of them never left Vietnam. So you could see that they're consuming YouTube videos, podcasts that are from the West and from outside of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. I think when I ask, like, is society ready? It's because there is this huge gap I'm finding between the youth who clearly have different directions and motivations than like this older generation that kind of creates these obstacles, like you guys are not patriotic or things like that. But ultimately the country will be run by the youth, right? So if we kind of just put faith into the youth, which is what Fulbright's mission is, then hopefully that'll be okay in the future. But when something like a disinformation campaign happens on an institution that is like pretty prestigious in Vietnam, it makes you kind of question, like, is society ready for this kind of place?
I think that society anywhere in the world is never ready for change. And it does require these huge ships that break the ice. You know, you have those ice breaking ships that are, you know, that need to go in and do it. And if not Fulbright, then who? It's not going to be RMIT. I think RMIT's specialty is different than Fulbright. Fulbright leans a little bit more into the liberal arts, and I think RMIT is a technical institution that leans heavily on business and probably other subjects beyond the liberal arts. I want to ask you both, what does it mean to be Vietnamese to you today?
We knew you were going to ask this.
This is the one thing we prepared.
Yeah. I have an answer. I can go first. So to me, being Vietnamese means being creative by freely borrowing from other cultures. And here's why I mean that. I mean, the name Vietnam, the name arguably comes from Yue Nan, which is a Chinese term, which literally means those people over there to the south of us. And it's a Chinese-centric term. And so it was called Indochina because the Indian influence and the Chinese influence. So we get our Buddhism from India, our Confucianism from China, our ideas of politics from the West and from France. And so, you know, even pho, it might come from the pot-au-feu. It might be a French thing. Who knows? Banh mi, obviously. Ao yai, Parisian influence, Chinese dress, but with Parisian influence. So basically, and even the famous tale of Gyu, right? By Nguyen Du. That is a Chinese novel, but then done. You know, so being Vietnamese is basically taking things and then just making it better. So I'm very proud of that. My answer.
Because I live in Vietnam now, I have these everyday occurrences that are always in tension with one another of how things should work and how things actually work. And sometimes the way that things work, like, actually is great in terms of, like, more convenience. But sometimes that unofficial way is super inconvenient, or, like, you know, it also lends its way to corruption. But currently, I think if you ask me this question, you know, 10 years from now, I'll have a different answer. But currently, it's this expression of convenience over control. And because I live in Vietnam, convenience wins. So I'm thinking about a bus. You know, when you go on a bus, for example, and there are 10 seats on the bus, but there are 15 people who want to go to Vung Tau. What does the bus driver do? All right, everybody, 15 people, just get in. Let's just everybody just jam in. It'll be a quick ride. We'll get there. And everybody is happy because everybody gets to go where they want to go. The bus driver gets a little bit of extra money for that trip. And it's great. Like, that is the modus operandi right now, even though that's not, like, the official way that things are supposed to work. So the convenience over control thing is winning out. Yeah.
Your answer is probably I've never heard that ever in the years that I've asked this question, but that's a cool response. And Kevin, you've put it eloquently what so many others have said about this, the way you framed it. But I do want to ask another question. And I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm going to do it. Who are some, I'll give you some time to think about this. Who are some of your modern day Vietnamese heroes, whether they're in Vietnam, whether they're in the diaspora, or whether they're in academics or film or wherever? But can you tell me some names of people that you modern day, it could be in the last 100 years, that you really follow and that you really
alive or did that to be
could
alive
be alive or dead, you know, but modern times, you know, maybe last 50 years that you really follow and that.
I was like, are you getting inspiration based on our heroes? Are you going to go look them up and ask them to be on your podcast?
Yes, I will. The modern ones, the ones that are still alive, I'm going to reach out to them. Yeah, they must have an Instagram account too, so yeah. I can, you know, reach out to them. I'm kidding. Like, I want to know who you both think are people that that really influence the culture and that are moving the needle or have moved the needle and laid some foundation to the modern Vietnamese, who we are becoming and where we're going.
Now, when you say we, is that Vietnamese Americans? Or is it just Vietnamese Americans and Vietnamese?
I think both. Vietnamese Americans and Vietnam from the homeland. Who's moving the needle? And if you have to break it down, you know, then I'd love to hear that. Like, is it Ocean Vuong? Is it Viet Thanh Nguyen for the Vietnamese diaspora? Who is doing that in Vietnam, right?
Yeah. I mean my kind of, I guess, simple answer. I mean, obviously to me, it's Viet Thanh Nguyen who first jumps to mind in the sense that he's really
your hero.
First off, there have always hero? No. Hold on. Wait. Okay.
Whoa! Tell me how you really feel.
Jeez, let me. Damn.
She just unleashed the fury. That's your hero.
Here's what I'm saying.
Well, no, guys, this is unedited. Like, we don't edit like here at the Vietnamese podcast.
Well, people know already.
All right. In some ways, he is very admirable, and in some sense, he is sort of a hero. Yes. Mm. What I'm saying is that he. There have always been Vietnamese American writers, Andrew Lam, you know, Andrew Pham, and many. But Viet Thanh Nguyen just made it blow up, you know. And what I like about Viet Thanh Nguyen, I mean, mean, he's a progressive and he's outspoken. My dad loves him. My dad and I are fans. So he's kind of, in a sense, paving that way, at least in the United States. I mean, I don't think anyone can deny that. I mean, he's huge. So, yeah.
Okay.
I didn't mean to like say it like that, I guess. I was just surprised. I didn't know that was your hero. But I think that answers the question about moving the needle.
I mean, I have other answers if you were to let me like go into the 20th century, but I meant like today, you know.
So. We're going to do that on the podcast I have with you. And then, Ian, I'm going to ask you the same question on the podcast I have with you later.
I think it's kind of hard for me because you've just sprung this question. I'm like,
No, I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Yeah, but a number of people do come up to mind. And like, I did think of Ocean Vuong because I do think he has a way with words. I don't want to say call him a hero, and I don't know if that's a role that he wants to fulfill for somebody who he doesn't know either. But I do think his words have the saving power. And then the other person I thought of pretty recently and who just passed away very tragically is Lin Kuei. Lin Kuei was an art curator and an artist, a contemporary artist. And he really changed the cultural space of Vietnam. And he co-founded the first public art space called San Art in Ho Chi Minh City. And that was really where a lot of artists could exhibit their work. There was really no other place that was public or for the public. So like, that's really important. And some of the arts that he's done on Agent Orange have been very provocative. Like when I think about it, I get the chills. But I think he's someone that will be missed dearly and has really changed just culturally that space for Vietnam. So,
And that cafe still exists in Hanoi, right?
Which one?
The artist space.
No, this is the San Art. Right? That still exists here. Yes, exists here. It's in Ho Chi Minh City.
Okay, mm-hmm. Sorry.
Yeah.
Now, since you guys are podcasters, do you guys have any questions for me before we go?
Yes, we do.
There's so many.
What's a recent surprising answer or perspective that you get? I won't go there, but. That's a general one. What is something that somebody said that kind of made you surprised?
You know, this answer is going to surprise you, but I have a very bad memory. I do. I have a really horrible memory. And unless I'm given some time to think about, that's why I'm very sensitive to putting people on the spot. Because of like what you're doing right now to me, I'm like a deer in the headlights. And I have learned to be honest with that and respond like honestly. Like, you know, if I had to really think about it, I'd have to go through and watch everything and then really think about like in the last year.
I have an easier question.
Yes.
How do you choose who to interview? What's that process?
Yeah. I am very open about this. For me, there's sort of like the two basic criteria is the past and the future. So the past needs to have serious work. Like I got to see like these guys or whoever it is that I bring on has got to have like a real history of doing the work, the heavy lifting, right? That's like number one requirement. The number two requirement is how much into the future, what's their trajectory into the work that they're going to be doing? I don't want somebody who is like what this offer? Person who's like this... one offer. Yeah. I don't like that. I like somebody who you have a feeling that they're going to just like never stop, you know, because I respect those two things. Like, what's your past work? How much heavy lifting have you done? And then like, do I get the feeling like you're going to take this to the day you die? Because that's how I live my life, right? I want to make sure, yeah, like I did the heavy lifting and I want to like, I want to mess with people and hang out with people that I know are going to be continuing to do probably even more heavy lifting. So those are my two criteria.
But like, how do you find them? Like, do you Google Vietnamese?
People send me links like all day long now. And then like, just by being around this so much, living in the heart of it. Yeah, it's a nonstop like train for me now. It's just constantly. And, you know, I can sniff out like who's like the fly by night one, you know, one offs. So I'm always open to watch and to see where the work develops into. Mm-hmm. But that all being said, there's also this idea of like new filmmakers, right? Young directors, you know, who don't have the heavy lifting years of it, but do they come with this certain oomph of their work? You know, have they been thinking about this in a critical way? So that's the criteria that really does it for me. And, you know, I've been off. I think maybe, you know, you can't have a perfect record in doing this. We're going to have it off sometime. And, you know, I've had people quit and I'm like, oh my God, I failed myself. Right. But, for the most part, that's how I pick the guests. So don't have to be famous. I don't care about social media numbers. None of that matters to me. What matters is the seriousness of the work and how they approach it. So you guys are like overqualified for this.
I appreciate that rationale, the past and the future, like, you know, have something to show for yourself, but also demonstrates a certain level of commitment. And that's definitely what committed or definitely what we are. We're not half-assed or any kind of people,
nope.
As you can tell. And you, but that reminds me of when we were excited to come on the podcast. I remember telling Kevin, I was like, it's a career milestone. That means that we're legitimate people.
Oh, we've been recognized. That's crazy to hear that.
As I don't know, committed enough now in Kenya's eyes.
Oh, I think I said we are officially Vietnamese.
Branded. And you know, with that being said,
I do hope that we develop a friendship and a relationship going into the next 30 years of our lives together here on Earth in this space, because and I mean that when I say, like, you know, I have friends that 40 years, you know, I have close friends that are 40 years, close friends that have been in my life for 30 years. I value friendship and the depth of human connection very, very much. And within the, you know, film space, you know, of 25, 30 years, many, many friends in that space that are in the podcast. And so in the podcast world that you are inhabiting with me and I'm inhabiting with you, I pray that we can exist together and be friends, and you can reach out and say, hey, can you introduce me to that guest? And if I can, I will. But there's, you know, like Ocean Vuong, I cannot, because I don't have that. I don't have a close relationship with them. I just have to go through an agent who reaches out to me when they have a book. And so I don't have that friendship with certain people. But if I do have that friendship, I would definitely pass it along. That's one thing I can be very generous about.
I just want to say exactly same. And I really appreciate you reaching out and letting this connection happen. I think it's really important that these conversations happen. And so thank you for offering this space, your podcast, for listeners to, you know, engage. And like today, let me just say, like, okay, right now, so I'm a professor. Right now I'm teaching a course on free speech. And one of the things that we were doing today was this theory of free speech that emphasizes thinkers. Basically, the argument is, in order for us to be thinkers, for us to develop our own beliefs and ideas, we need other people. So I made my students do an activity. It was fascinating. I just tried it for the first time today, like right before this podcast. I had them all silently think to themselves no looking at phones, no writing, no nothing, just sitting and thinking for 3 minutes about a belief they have about themselves or the world or whatever, any belief. And then share that with a stranger, another student, where the stranger listens and asks questions. And almost all of them were like, when I was by myself, I just couldn't think. Like, I couldn't come up with reasons for my belief. I just kept repeating the same sentence. I hit a wall. But the moment I have another person in front of me as a sounding board, I could actually develop the ideas. I could justify the ideas. So the point I'm trying to make is that when listeners listen to a podcast, yeah, they're not able to speak and then be responded to, but they're still hearing the dialogue that's doing some thinking, you know, that they can think along with.
Yeah.
So it's basically developing thinkers for the Vietnamese community. That's very cool.
Yeah. And I want to let you both know that I am not as busy as you think I am. You can always reach out and say, hey, let's schedule a podcast. We want to talk about this subject. And I'm down. My door is always open for all my friends and previous guests to do that and reach out and say, hey, we got this idea. We'd like to come on and talk about it. So I'm publicly letting you guys know that the door is always open. I respect the work that you both do. And I hope that we have a fruitful time on Earth for the next few decades together.
Thank you, Kenneth. It was
such
a pleasure to talk to you and get to know you and be on your podcast.
Thank you.
Very much agree. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.